Hey, what's up, Quarter Cutter Squad? Welcome back to the podcast. On this episode, we have Benny Lewis, who you may know from quite some time back with Fluent in 3 months, but we find out where he's been over the past few years, his thoughts on immersion, fluency, and his goals in the future. If you guys want to support the podcast, definitely give the video version of the episode on YouTube a watch, and be sure to destroy the like button over there. Also, feel free to check out our Patreon. We recently started a book club where we're reading Welcome to the NHK, and we have meetings on Discord. Any support on Patreon really goes a long way for us, and if you're in the market for some good vibes and a positive community, be sure to join our Discord at discord.gg/korekara. You can also find the link in our Twitter bio. But as always, hope you guys enjoy the podcast.
All right, so Benny, can you give us a quick background of who you are and where you're at today?
So, I am Benny from Ireland. I have a degree in electronic engineering. When I was in school, I took German for 5 years and the Irish language for 10 years, and I did miserably with both of them. I always thought that there was this language gene and that, like, maybe it's a left brain, right brain thing. And I was a tech guy. I was good at mathematics and technology. I'm bad at the arts and languages, and that's what I told myself until I got into my 20s. And I moved to Spain after I graduated, and I lived there for 6 entire months, and I did not learn any Spanish because, like many expats, I just gravitated to the English-speaking community. And what started to convince me was I was part of this exchange program with other engineers, and they were arriving with the same lack of Spanish that I was. And with time, they actually started to get better and better at Spanish. And it really challenged this idea I had that maybe engineers can't learn a language. And from there, I had my first true attempt to learn a language, which was Spanish. And I managed to succeed with that after a while. And from there, I continued traveling. That was in 2003. So for about 18 years, I have been on the road learning languages, and that's been the theme of my travels. And of course, I started Fluent in 3 months to document my language learning story so I could share that with other people. And that's grown since I started it. I've published a bunch of books. I've worked with National Geographic. I've given TEDx talks that you guys were just saying you saw. But mainly what I'm trying to do with everything is to inspire other people who feel like they don't have the language gene, and to really squash that myth that languages are for language people. I do not consider myself a language person, even though I do this for a living. And yet I have managed to break through this barrier. And that's what I try to inspire other people to do as well.
Yeah. That's super inspiring to hear. But I guess a lot of our listeners are probably really interested in the method that you use specifically to learn languages, because Fluent in 3 months, a lot of people would think that's something that's not possible, or even to get to a base level, especially for Asian languages. But could you describe like what that method is and how you developed it?
Yeah, so the concept of Fluent in 3 months definitely has a lot of controversy with it. And I think when I first interacted with the online language community, there was a very big misalignment with what we understood as language learning. And I think I have interacted with a lot more people from a wider scope of language learning over the years. And I think that for most people, fluency in 3 months is just not going to be realistic, because they're learning a language part-time. It's something that maybe someday they would like to be able to do. And it's not practical to do that in a short burst of time. Now, on the other hand, I came from an experience where I was trying to live in the country and avoid using the language. So that level of necessity changes things quite a lot, that I have to learn this language within a certain time span, or I'm just not going to have any friends. I'm not going to be able to interact with people. So that's really reframed it, that learning the language was my full-time job. And for a lot of my intensive projects, I've generally put over 8 hours a day and lived and breathed the language and completely avoided using English. And that changes what's possible. And from there, like I For me, fluency means social equivalency. So very specifically, if any of your readers or listeners are used to the European Common Framework, that B2 level, where essentially you could go to a pub and someone could talk to you at regular speed about most commonly discussed things in your life, and you can have that conversation with them, they can talk with one another and speak at regular speed, and that for me is the beginnings of fluency. You can go on into the advanced C levels, and that's where you start to talk about more technical subjects. So I've got a C2 diploma, and I've studied this for the C2 exam in several of my languages, and what that means is I can work as an electronic engineer in those languages. And that's impressive and that's amazing, but ultimately, realistically, at least for me and for a lot of people I tend to talk with when it comes to languages, they want to be able to interact with people. So that's where the concept of like, how can you do this quickly comes in. And the core of my approach is speak from day one. The biggest mistake that I made in that Spanish project that I said that I failed at for 6 months was I had this idea in mind that if I study enough Spanish, eventually I'll have this eureka moment and I'll suddenly be able to speak Spanish. Once I've learned enough conjugations or I've crammed enough vocabulary into my brain, then I will be ready. And like the analogy I like to give people is this is effectively like imagining you wanted to learn how to ride a bike, and the way you did that was by studying aerodynamics. And you never put your ass on an actual saddle because you're convinced, you know, if I just watch YouTube videos of BMX experts doing loop-de-loops, then I'll be able to like ride my bike a few meters down the road. And of course, that's not how it works. You have to get on the bike, you have to fall. You have to build up that muscle memory of actually trying to use it. And it's going to suck. And this is the thing about, I always tell people, I do not have the easy way to learn the language. The hard way is you're going to make mistakes. You're going to have to learn in front of somebody. There's going to be embarrassing moments, but you get that out of your system and you push through it. And this approach of speak from day one has completely transformed my language learning experience. And it's what the theme of the beginning stages are for me. The later stages tend to be, for me at least, are pretty standard and traditional. I would do very academic things to improve my reading skills, to polish my grammar. But the way I get momentum in the language initially is by speaking it from the absolute beginning, no matter how bad I am, no matter how few words I know. And that's something I've implemented for every language project ever since then.
Right. Yeah, I think anybody who's reached fluency in a foreign language knows that to be the case. Like we were talking about this with another guest, but it's kind of like how for programming, it's really comforting to maybe just take courses and not actually get real experience. But if you really want to learn, you have to like go and like be uncomfortable and figure out how things work. And I think it's the same for languages. But I was curious, like, did you develop this method at all, like from an engineering perspective? Because I know you interviewed Tim Ferriss and he talks about like the 80-20 principle of how he learned like 20% of the top most used kanji, and that allowed him to read 80% of most material. Like, did you incorporate any like engineering principles in your method?
Absolutely. And the thing that separates engineers from scientists is that if you're a scientist and you're studying the likes of physics, then you can make these perfectionist assumptions that there's no wind resistance or whatever if you're making a bridge. In the real world, that doesn't exist. Engineers have to deal with imperfection. And if an engineer waited until all conditions were perfect, we would not have any technology and there'd be no advances whatsoever. You have to accept the world is imperfect. So this has been the core of my philosophy, that I really fight perfectionism. And it's why when I'm getting into a language, I tell people that ultimately my goal on a day-to-day basis is, can I make at least 200 mistakes this day? And that's very counterintuitive because a lot of people are like, no, my goal is I'm supposed to speak the language perfectly. I can't make mistakes. But the problem is if you're a learner, you have to make mistakes. You have to speak and speak incorrectly, Your pronunciation isn't going to be great. You're maybe going to use an incorrect word. The world does not open up and swallow you whole and send you to hell if you make a little mistake. You just have to try. It's really, at this stage, I've learned to just accept this feeling that at the start, I'm going to sound a little bit like Tarzan if I'm speaking whatever language that is, and work through that. And I do get better and better with practice. Practice is so important. And with language learnings, for so many people, they may practice like aspects of the language, like they may practice reviewing vocabulary and practice exercises, but they're not actually practicing using the language. And like a good analogy somebody told me recently is, if you imagine children and reading, what happens in the first years of a child's life is, first they learn to read, and then they read to learn. And this is the way I like to think of languages, is at first I'm learning this language, but as soon as possible, I want to use that language in truly live, actual situations, like trying to make a new friend or watching a TV show or even flicking through TikTok and just trying to get content in the language that way. The ways that I would naturally use it in, I would naturally use my mother tongue. I try to make the language become a tool for me. And as an engineer, I have never put languages on a pedestal. And it's why, like, unlike a lot of people that you may have on this podcast, I actually don't care about language learning. I am not passionate about learning languages. I am passionate about other cultures. I am passionate about making friends from around the world. And because of that, the language is a tool. The language is just a screwdriver for me to unlock, that analogy has lost me. The screwdriver is going to use a door, but you know what I mean. It's a tool to open your door to another culture. And because of that, it's okay if it's imperfect. So that engineering mindset has absolutely come through. And like you said, with Tim Ferriss, I have a similar mindset to the Pareto principle, where the 20% gives you the 80%. So people who would like say, well, you're not fluent in the language unless you know the word shoelace in the language. And I'm like, well, when are you going to say shoelace? Like, yeah, sure. Later on in the language, it is important to make sure you're filling in those final gaps. But as a beginner, I'm very specific that there are a certain amount of conversations I'm likely to have. And if I'm having lots of conversations on Skype with a teacher online, or if I'm living in the country and I'm starting to socialize, those are pretty predictable conversations where I'm maybe talking about myself and I'm asking them about themselves. And I want to know the kind of words they tend to talk about. I don't need to be prepared for an epistemological debate on Kantian philosophy. That does not need to happen at the drop of a hat. If it happens, I'll say, I'm sorry, I'm not ready for that conversation. But generally, it doesn't tend to happen. So that is a more practical way of deciding, there's a certain amount of vocabulary that is essential. I'll focus on that. And I'm not going to care so much about the words that maybe come up. And I'm going to, if I have to piece together using the words I do know to describe the thing that I don't know yet. If I don't know the word for car, I mean, that's a very basic word. If I don't know that, I'd say, oh, the thing with four wheels. And just by saying the thing with four, it gets you set up to be able to expand the little that you have further. And like I said, I try to have a dynamic learning approach. So everything I've been talking about gets very messy when you get into the advanced stages, that, you know, you don't want to be having all these gaps in your language. You don't want to be making these mistakes. But you have to have, at the beginning stages, a bigger space in your life for making these mistakes, because that'll give you progress way faster. So you get to that intermediate stage ready to polish things up and really get in on the difficult words and grammar and so on.
Yeah, I think that's a really cool perspective, and also fresh perspective of how you're interested in the culture, and then as a result, you learn the language. But I think a lot of our listeners, they mostly know you from you had a very famous challenge of trying to learn Japanese in a very short period of time. And so can you share like some background about that challenge and maybe like share like what worked for that challenge and what didn't work?
Absolutely, yeah. And I have successful and unsuccessful projects all the time. And Japanese was among my less successful projects, but I did at least in the 2 months, and people are welcome to see that I put my money where my mouth is, and I, from day one, would speak. And you can see videos of me sharing my conversations on Skype at the start. They're cringeworthy if you speak Japanese very well, but if you're an absolute beginner, then you see somebody try to speak that language. And I'm very proud of the fact that I did, in those 2 months, push my Japanese to at least that basic conversational level. And like, that was by simply speaking it all the time. And I had to make a few adjustments. So when it comes to both Chinese and Japanese, because I know that reading is not going to be central to my initial project of speaking, this means that learning kanji, or in the case of Chinese, learning Hanzi, this is not a priority for me. And so I said that from the absolute start, that all the vocabulary that I was putting into my flashcard decks, those were going to be presented in hiragana, katakana only. So I'd learn those because they're not that hard to learn in a short amount of time. But I only need the phonetic equivalent sounds of the language because I don't plan to read it right now. Doesn't mean I'll never plan to read it, but to be practical, if you have a spoken focus, that's what you need to make of it. So at the 2 month point, I reached that stage where I could have basic conversations with a patient speaker, definitely not fluent, because like I said before, fluent levels, they need to be able to talk naturally to you. And the mistakes I made in that project, I think part of them were personal life challenges that I had, but in general, I didn't really have a good idea of what I was going to do in Japan. So I did end up going to Japan, but it was mostly just a touristy trip. I didn't have a truly full level of immersion that I feel like I've had in so many other countries. So the big, and I'm sure so many of your guests say this, the big why of the reason behind what you're doing this needs to be there. And for me, a big why, a big motivating factor in a lot of my projects is I'm going to go to that country, spend considerable time there, and I'm going to make friends in that country. At the time, I was traveling with an English-speaking partner, and that completely changed my dynamic as I was going to go to the country, that I knew I was going to spend more time with her and not necessarily immersing myself in the culture. So that kind of took a lot of that pressure that I need to be there off me. So that's part of the problem. But ultimately, like people would always say, well, you know, Asian languages in particular are going to be harder. And absolutely, there's no doubt about it. There's less common vocabulary and so on. But for me, this whole concept, I consider it to be useless. It's nothing more than mental masturbation, just deciding, do you know what? My language is the hardest language. And it's more of an ego thing. It's like, I've learned Japanese, you haven't, and I put this work in, and I want you to know how hard Japanese is because of that. But the thing is, I've heard this line over and over again. I've heard Hungarian is the hardest language, French is the hardest language, Arabic is the hardest language, Chinese is the hardest language, Japanese is the hardest. I've just, every single time. And it all comes from a place of ego and pride. It's not I wrote this very detailed article where I was trying to address concerns someone had about why Chinese is the hardest language in the world. And the guy who wrote the article had not actually ever truly learned any other language. So he was making this bold assumption without any experience of other languages. And the thing is, learning languages is difficult. It definitely has that aspect of adjusting to like these brand new sounds. I have to understand what they mean and I have to try to produce sounds myself. That is an adjustment. But because of that, like I wouldn't have said that like Japanese in particular had aspects of the language that slowed me down from getting into that beginning speaking stage. Obviously, there's advanced aspects of Japanese that I don't know anything about that I can't speak to. But it definitely did not fit an exception to the rule of speak from day one. And I'm pretty happy with that basic conversational level I reached in 2 months, because so many people will put years into learning a language like Japanese and not get to that level. And I did not get to that level because I'm smarter than them. I really emphasize this to people. I do not have any innate language talent. I just embrace sounding like an idiot. And I'm okay with that. And that helps me push through it. And because that, I got to that stage. And I definitely plan to... I'm back into a mode right now where I can travel solo again. And I definitely plan to return to Japanese at some stage. I'll share that project with people when it comes around to it. I'll try and aim high. And do you know what? Maybe I failed. But the thing is, if you aim as high as possible and really push yourself, that's how you know you're going to drive yourself forward. I feel too many people have very vague ideas of, you know, like New Year's is coming around and people will say, oh, I'm making a New Year's resolution. I want to speak Japanese. And they don't, that doesn't mean anything. Like, what you need to have your basic smart objectives, you know, specific, measurable, all those things. And that's where my concept of fluent in 3 months comes from, is I know what fluency means. I know what 3 months means. I have these very specific ideas in mind. I'm going to push myself as much as possible. If I fall short of that, it was intentionally as ambitious as possible, so that falling short of it still lands me somewhere very useful to be able to get to know that culture.
Yeah, and I guess going towards the sound aspect that you mentioned briefly, how would you say sounding in a language, because accents and pitch across various languages are definitely essential or vital to, I guess, fluency toward in a definition, right? So I guess for your fluent in 3 months, or purely your definition of fluency, where would you say the pitch kind of goes into that, and how you approach that angle?
Yeah, it's a very interesting concept, and I put considerable time into learning like the musicality of several languages that I have taken on. But realistically, I do not think that's a good use of people's time when they're just about reaching the beginning stages of fluency. Because yes, you're going to have an accent and you just need to get over that. So many people are so obsessed with the fact that I need to sound like a Japanese native speaker that they're losing sight of what they could potentially still do with an accent. Even though you have an accent, you could still make friends. You could still have a rich life in the country. Now, when I'm at the advanced stages in a language, this is something I've done with my top languages. So, for instance, with my Portuguese, I had a project, and I blogged about this, where I wanted by the end of my project to potentially make actual Brazilians think that I was Brazilian. And the great thing about Brazil is you have every ethnicity there. So the fact that I was a white guy, you don't have that challenge that I would have in Japan, that obviously take one look at me, I'm clearly not Japanese, you know. But the way I did it was I got singing lessons. And a language teacher, it can be very, very smart about all those information points about how the grammar is, expressions, all that. But generally, language teachers are lacking in these truly phonetic understandings of how to express how their language sounds. So, like, she was teaching me that in Germanic languages like English, we separate our words like this. But when you're speaking Portuguese from Brazil, you got to go up and down all the time and speak through your nose. And she got me to do this consistently so that I really got that accent down. And the pitch, the tonality, all of these things are so crucial if you want to sound like a native speaker, but that's not essential until you're at that stage. My Portuguese is at a C-level stage. I've learned plenty of it. I've had so many experiences. I've given talks in Portuguese. So it's at the level where I'm ready and I'm able to move on to that. Whereas in the intermediate stages, it's just not a good use of my time, because the goal is, can I have smooth communication with this person? And I want that communication to be as smooth as possible. that needs to be your priority. And this is all coming back to the Pareto principle. What are the 20% of the things that are going to give you 80% of the results? And working on your pitch and your intonation and your pronunciation is not something that belongs in that 20% when you're an intermediate level speaker. And this is a tough pill to swallow because people hate having an accent. And it's just part of the game. And I just accept, as an intermediate level speaker, I have to have an accent. I'll get around to, if I push this language into the advanced stages, I'll get around to all those other things. And if I do get around to them, then I would generally work with somebody with a bit of a musical background, and they would train me to have that particular accent in essence that, you know, I now with the likes of my Spanish, for instance, I can switch between European Spanish and Argentine Spanish and most recently Mexican Spanish intonation and like sound to the language. I wouldn't necessarily say they would think I'm a native speaker in those languages like I achieved in Portuguese, but it definitely has changed my experience with those people that they feel like I'm one of their group. It does make a difference when you're ready to make that difference. The people's mentality about you changes. They don't think of you as the foreigner as much, and they invite you to different things. It works on a subconscious level, but it's only useful when you're already at the advanced stage in the language.
Yeah, I think it also kind of depends, though, on the language itself. Like, I know, for example, like for Japanese, there's pitch accent, but it's not really super important for communication because all the prefectures have different pitch accents, so people can still understand you if you have wrong pitch accent. But for example, for Chinese, if you don't have at least like 60% accuracy with tones, it's pretty hard to understand what you're trying to say, right?
Absolutely. And this is why I say you have to like come back to that Pareto principle, and ultimately getting your tones wrong, this completely messes up your communication. So when I talk about tonality, I mean languages where that's more a nice to have thing. Whereas the tones in Mandarin, those are essential. So like I thought initially with my Mandarin project, which was more of a success than my Japanese one, I thought, do you know what, maybe I can put off the tones and people might still understand me. At first I thought that, and it was a complete disaster. And even if I was sure I was saying the words, my tones were all crazy all over the place. So I had to dedicate like 2 full weeks where my only priority was tones. I wasn't really learning that much extra vocabulary. I wasn't getting a lot of spoken practice. I was drilling, can I say these tones correctly individually? Can I say them in a sentence correctly? Can I take these online listening exercises and hear the word and be like, is that the first tone, the second tone, or whatever it is? And when it's something that truly makes a difference for communication, obviously that brings it way more to the forefront. What I was saying before is more like getting to the stage of where you want to sound like a native speaker in ways that doesn't actually make a difference for your ability to communicate. But absolutely what you said, like if the pitch and the tone is a crucial aspect of basic communication, that has to then come to the forefront. So I did work on that with Mandarin. And I always tell people with the tones, there are analogies, like people say, oh, I'm tone deaf. I always try to fight these like mentalities with people. The tone deafness is an actual condition that some people have, and they use that to, well, you know, I can't sing karaoke. That is not the same thing as not being able to say tones in Mandarin, because if you understand the difference between, you know, you are okay and you're okay. Now, these like very basic question tonalities we have in English, if you understand that difference, obviously you're not tone deaf in a way that matters for learning a language like Mandarin. So people have a lot of reasons why they may say, well, I don't have that knack. And I would always argue against that. I'd say, of course, you can find evidence that why you don't have that knack. It's like Henry Ford once said, whether you think you can or think you can't, you're right. And so I think like anyone listening to this, if they have like retorts like, yeah, but this is the reason why I am destined to fail. You know, it's not like I can argue against that. But I think that if you embrace these things, it truly just becomes your reality. And it's why I've always tried to find, do you know what? What are the reasons why I could argue that Japanese is easy? And this is a very difficult thing in the online language community, because like I said, there's an ego part of it that you want, if you've achieved the language, you want other people to think you've achieved this very hard thing. And I understand that. But at the same time, as a beginner learner, that is completely useless to me. I don't care why you think the language is hard. I want to know what are the ways I can advance quickly. And those ways involve discussing why the language is actually easy. There's a long list of reasons why a language like Japanese, which doesn't have the tones of Chinese, it doesn't have a lot of features of Germanic and Slavic languages that make those especially hard. It doesn't have the future subjunctive like Portuguese. There's a lot of things it just doesn't have. But of course, you could say, yeah, but it does have this, it does have that. And I'm like, yeah, fine, you're not wrong, but that is not useful if you're trying to be motivated. And I do learn these things that are hard, but I don't try to get them to bog me down, because your mentality is so important when it comes to language learning. You need to see what is going to inspire me, because that motivation, if that runs dry, then it doesn't matter if you have the best learning technique in the world, the best apps, or like thousands of dollars of books and learning courses. If your motivation isn't there, then you're not going to learn the language.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. It's kind of like, if you think you won't succeed, there's pretty much no way you will. Like, it's not going to just happen magically. But yeah, earlier when you're talking about how people say they're tone deaf so they can't learn tones, I thought about how, like, so I'm a native Chinese speaker, and I have some like Chinese speaking friends who are tone deaf, but so it's like, clearly there is not connected at all. You can speak fluent, you can be native level in Chinese, but be completely tone deaf.
But, of course.
But you're actually still learning Mandarin right now, right?
Yes. So I've just reactivated my Mandarin. Like before this, I had an italki lesson. And it's one of the more successful brief projects that I had, because at the end of it, I didn't reach like B2 level fluency, but I did reach B1 level conversational. And this was evaluated independently by a Chinese school in Beijing when I visited. And it meant that when I travel through China, I have some experiences that I'm going to cherish for the rest of my life. That I got taught Kung Fu by this Kung Fu master in a village. And I got to flirt with this really cute girl on a train, like outside of Xi'an. And like all these random things.
Ultimate that motivation.
All these random things that just like completely enriched my experience that I would never have had if I only spoke English or if my Mandarin was at a much lower level. And I had so much fun. So I'm reactivating it now, because essentially I started traveling in 2003. I met this lady and she kind of threw me off my routine a lot. And for several years, I wasn't actively learning languages. I went through a lot of personal struggles, financial problems, depression. And now I'm coming out of all of that and I'm getting back into next summer when my lease ends in this house. I'm going back into full-time travels, like all the time, where everything I own in the world has to weigh less than 23 kilograms so I can check it in with me. And it's why I'm like feeling that motivation again. And like 2 years ago, I was not in a place where I could reactivate my Mandarin, because I was in a very low place in my life. And there's no amount of methods or discussions that were going to work to get me out of that lull. So for some people, it really, I appreciate when for some people, language learning actually helps them to get out of that lull. It gives them that inspiration. It helps them to think outside of their the box that they may be trapped in, that they see things from the outside world and they get inspired for when someday they may move to Japan. So that can actually help a lot of people. But yeah, I'm actively learning Mandarin. And part of the reason is that I've actually co-written a book based on my experience with the people my experience when I learned Mandarin. a professor of Chinese. Help me write this. Language hacking Mandarin. So this has just been published. This is what I looked like before the stress of New York. So the, you know, the double chin has kind of come in since this image. But that takes the concepts of this is not going to get you fluent in Mandarin. It's going to get you speaking Mandarin to that basic conversational level. And this is because this book's just been published, I'm going to be doing a book tour. I obviously want to be able to talk to people who come to that book tour in Mandarin. So I'm working intensively to get my level back to where it was when I stopped learning Mandarin like 7 years ago. So I'm taking like 3 or 4 lessons a week with teachers. And it's amazing how quickly it starts to come back.
You kind of mentioned consistency, I guess, in terms of that you, I guess when you weren't in the zone for learning, or I guess learning any language, you weren't doing any learning at all, right? And I mean, from the guests that we've had on the podcast, we've seen that a lot of their success has just come down to very small bits of language learning every day, compounded over time, and shown how important that is. So how important would you say, in your opinion, those small bits every single day matter?
So I'm going to give a little bit of a controversial answer to this. I think everyone you've had on before, that what they say is absolutely valid, and that's important for a lot of people to do something small every day. And I'm friends with James Clear, who's written Atomic Habits, and that's the same kind of principle. The little things you do every day add up. So that is absolutely true. Now, in my case, it's a little bit different. I have ADHD, so I have these attention issues where if I don't have a true goal and a true project that is pushing me with a language, I'm not necessarily going to be able to get a lot of benefit out of doing a little bit every day. I need to have something I'm working towards. And more recently, with some of my languages, I've been like trying to make TikToks in those languages. And that's kind of motivated me to like research a lot of the upcoming cultural and like trending topics that are happening in different countries. And that's really helped me, but that's a bigger thing than a 5 minutes a day. And I think, like, I'm a little cynical about a lot of things. And I think, you know, a lot of people would use an app like Duolingo for 5 minutes a day, and they think that that counts for something. And nothing against Duolingo in particular, but I don't think using an app like that briefly over the long time is going to make that big of a difference. It may, you know, keep something on life support that you're getting. It's definitely better than nothing, that you're getting some exposure. But like, it depends on the person. And so many people listening to this, maybe they have a completely different way of approaching things. But the whole reason that I have a whole Fluent in 3 Months brand is because I need to do things intensively. This is how I've transformed languages in my life. And I need to have something that's pushing me with that language. So I have to put several hours a day into something. Now, having said that, like a year ago, I did try to start reactivating some languages in my life, and I did do little pieces of something a day. And it was definitely better than nothing to get me feeling like, you know, I'm starting to use this language in some form. But I would be a little skeptical of that in terms of long-term results. I think it is better if you have a true project and you're giving considerable time, at least an hour a day, where you might have to make sacrifices and you might have to give up your Netflix shows in English. If you're socializing a lot in your native language, you may have to decide, well, maybe I'm only going to socialize once a week so that the time opens up, that I now have these evenings I can put into language learning. And it needs to be a priority for you to make a lot of progress. The great thing is, when you've made enough progress, it can just be a natural part of your life. Like I said, you learn to read and then you read to learn. And now with my Spanish, I don't have any kind of learning that feels like a learning experience with Spanish, but I'm still genuinely actively using Spanish in very regular ways. Like, I currently live in Texas. There's a lot of Spanish-speaking immigrants, and I hang out with them. I'm making content on other platforms in Spanish. I'm absorbing their content. I'm reading the newspaper in Spanish. There's a lot of things that have just made it a natural part of my life. the things I would do anyway. And like, you know, as I was saying at the start, I'm a techie kind of guy. And if I want to edit a video and I run into a problem in After Effects, I will search on YouTube in Spanish. How do I solve this problem that, you know, it's crashing or something, it's giving a blank frame or whatever. I'll try to search for that in Spanish, watch the tutorial in Spanish, and then it's truly a part of my life. And that changes the whole experience. And this is why, like, I'm skeptical of this, you know, 5 minutes on swiping through an app to say, like, you know, I've done something. I think it has merit. And if that's all you have the motivation to do now, then do that. And that'll hopefully get you started. I think that's the same as, like, if people say you want to get in shape, the first step is just, you know, I'll put on my gym clothes at the start of the day. There's something to be said for that. That gets you started, even if you're not actually like exercising that day, but you're getting over that initial hump that maybe you can get in a routine where you're actually going to the gym or going for a run or something. And that's why I think, like, if these open the floodgates, that's great. But for me personally, I don't really get that much benefit out of little 5 minute chunks of doing something in a language.
I actually say that's consistent with what our guests have done, because I guess for some clarity, they actually go and immerse for like 3-4 hours a day and then have like an hour of reviews. So I guess the little bit every day is a lot compared to Duolingo, for example. We actually did a calculation for if you were to do 5 minutes every day, how long would it take to get fluent in the language, given the I think we searched up that it would take 5,000 hours for Japanese. So we used that benchmark. It would take 165 years, 5 minutes a day.
And I would argue that it would, you after 165 years, you definitely would not be fluent. This is the, like the bike analogy, you could study all the aerodynamics. If you've never actually tried to speak the language, if you've never put your ass on a saddle and fallen off, because that's what happens when we learn to ride a bike, then, you know, so I would argue it's more than 165 years.
That would be disappointing for that guy.
We had that one 165-year-old watching the video, just a tear shedding down their face right now. Apologies, but maybe go a little bit harder.
Yeah. But Benny, earlier you were talking about how, like, a couple years ago you had a personal low point, and you also made a video pretty recently about, like, your personal growth of how you were able to, like, grow past that. So can you share, like, that, like, kind of journey to our audience?
Yeah, so essentially I had a lot of stuff happen to me in a very short time. I got divorced. I got over $80,000 in personal debt. I got even in more debt with my company. I was extremely exhausted because in writing my original language hacking courses, I had 20-hour days where I was barely sleeping. So I was completely burnt out from work, and I ended up being clinically depressed because of all of this. Like, I had to take depression medicine, which had mixed results, and it was just the lowest point in my life. And it's when you're that low, it can just feel like getting anywhere is like climbing a mountain, because I had multiple problems that I had to solve. And like many people would have said before, if you want to climb a mountain, you just have to do it one step at a time. And that's essentially what I worked on, is can I get to a place where I had all these huge problems and I tried to just take them one at a time. Financially, can I get on top of my finances? I watched a lot of YouTube videos about financial management, and I changed a lot of things. I moved away from New York, which was very expensive. I started having a cheaper life, and that was its own process, and I focused on that. And then next was to improve my spirits, and that was its own separate challenge. So, like, each one of these, I've given them their own time. And I've had to accept in this experience that, like, even though being a polyglot is so central to my personality these days, it's my online brand, I'm genuinely passionate about using other languages. May not be passionate about learning languages, but I'm really, truly passionate about using languages and getting to know other cultures. So it was a hard pill for me to swallow that do you know what? For the short term, I can't be that person. And if anyone's listening and they're going through a rough time in their life, and maybe they're finding that learning Japanese is not helping them get out of that rut, I would even say maybe now is not the time to be learning Japanese. Maybe you have to learn, you have to work on your own personal issues in other ways, make them the priority. And this would mean that when you come back, even if it's a whole year from now, a year feels like such a long way off. But when we all think about how this pandemic has impacted us, that like the time has flown. And this has been one of the things for me that I have implemented things like Atomic Habits to make small adjustments to my finances, small adjustments to my personal health, my mental health, and to get to a better place in my life. And they have built up over time that every day I'm trying to be 1% better. And that has kind of exponentially improved, that now I'm feeling like I have this drive that I used to have before all these very difficult years for me. And I've got that language passion back. So I'm hoping just the fact that this is so central to my life, that if I like give people permission that it's okay if you're going through a struggle and you can't be a polyglot, you can't be that Japanese speaker right now, it does not mean you'll never be that speaker. Maybe it means in the short term, you need to work to get to yourself to a better place, and then you'll have the energy. Because especially the level of language learning that I do, the level of intensity, it requires energy. It requires motivation. And I was all out of that for several years. So I had to accept I don't have what it takes to be a language learner right now. But that's okay. I'm going to work on myself, and then I can get back to that place maybe a little bit later. It took me several years, and I'm glad I made that investment.
Yeah, wow. I mean, first of all, I'm really glad that you got out of that. I mean, it's better for not just you, but the entire community who has kind of been around you this entire time. So on behalf of all of them, we're glad you're back. And I guess you kind of shared some insights that not only you got from that entire process, but from your kind of insights that you got onto language learning itself, that from that being in that position. And I guess kind of going off that as well, would you say that you've kind of seen your motivation in language learning in a new light as well? Because you mentioned that you like having that pressure to kind of push you to go and learn the language. And right now you have the book coming out. And that of course is a great motivator to go and learn, brush up on your Mandarin. But would you say there's maybe other motivators that are kind of bringing you up there as well after this experience?
Absolutely, because I'm going to be back into full-time travels, and this is who I'm meant to be. I'm supposed to be on the road. This is how I found the best balance in my life and how I've created the most memories for myself. And it has its own challenges, but because I'm going to be traveling, I'm not going to be in an English-speaking country the majority of the time like I have been in recent years. So this means returning to Taiwan and returning to mainland China and having a project where I really try to kick my Japanese up to that fluent level and hopefully beyond. Those are realistic now for me. And, you know, recently I've got like all these projects, even in the short term. Like I've decided I was going to be at an event that actually speaks Esperanto, if you guys have ever come across that language. I was going to be at an event for New Year's, and unfortunately that fell through because of Mr. Rona decided to cancel everything in Germany. So I'm going to go to Mallorca for a few weeks. So that's given me inspiration. I'm going to relearn my Catalan because I learned Catalan while I was in Barcelona. I'm going to push it up a notch, and I'll actually still get to practice my... I was going to go to Germany, but they call Mallorca the like 17th district of Germany or whatever it is. So I'll actually get to practice my German again. And those are real world things that, you know, rather than theoretically someday I might use these languages, I have these real world motivators, and I really do look forward to when I can get back on the road again, and I'll have these upcoming travels, and they will help to drive me, because there's still so much for me to discover and explore in countries like China, definitely Japan, because I had a very touristy experience there, which is very different to so many experiences I've had in other countries. So I really want to truly experience Japan the same way I have other countries. So it is definitely on my short list within the next years that I'll get back there. And you can bet before I go, that'll be my big motivator that I'll be intensively relearning Japanese.
Nice. Yeah, I'm actually from Taiwan originally, so yeah, I'm really excited to follow your journey if you make videos about your travels.
Love to hear, especially as for people who are kind of interested in that as borders start opening up. Because I know a lot of people, especially during the, got a whole interest in learning a new language and going out there and traveling. So kind of hearing that is great, and hopefully they can follow you along your journey as well as your journeys as well to kind of see what they can do moving forward in this new world like you mentioned here. But I think after hearing about, it's been an inspirational conversation so far, especially hearing how far you've come as well as what was successful for you, what wasn't. And it kind of comes down over here at the Korekara podcast where we have the message to the listeners in the end, where after going full circle, it comes back to them. You can drop I think you've dropped so many words of wisdom already, but in terms of a message to everyone here listening, what would you maybe say to them?
I would say mistakes are your friend, whether that be in ways that you could expand your social circle in the language that you have to make mistakes, or if you're just doing the core learning of the language and potentially speaking with people, mistakes are good. I would say if you have an inner perfectionist, try to work around that. Try to have a goal of something like I said, I'm going to make 200 mistakes today, because that's how you're going to make progress. The world is imperfect. As you said, I'm an engineer. I look at the Pareto principle. What can I get out of the 20%? And that involves me embracing the fact that it is not going to sound that good, but this is just a part of the process. Does not mean that, you know, you can't teach an old dog new tricks and that your mistakes are going to be fossilized into you forever. It just means that right now, mistakes are what you need to make, and eventually you will have a place in the language will have a place in your life where those mistakes won't be as central anymore. So get out there and make mistakes.